follow are really regulations for the purpose of limiting and preventing exploitation of the parties involved in this messy world. Interestingly, and we have to make this pretty clear, I think, as we begin, the ESV translates the word eved in Hebrew. Eved is the word, but it translates that word slave. And in the English language, the word slave has a lot of connotations, particularly in the United States for us. So we have to be careful what we're dealing with here. Because the word eved really can be translated maybe more particularly in the Israelite culture as an indentured servant. The difference is that this word would not have been used to describe the relationship that Israel was under the Egyptians. In other words, you wouldn't have called that kind of slavery by the word eved. You would have talked about it with a different word. So this word refers more to one who has entered into a contractual relationship with another, a master, for the purpose of carrying out certain conditions. Usually it's an indebtedness. A person puts himself in servitude to another because they're indebted. And that's the second verse here. It applies the situation particularly to a fellow Hebrew, for whatever reason, who's got himself into servitude because of debt that he owes. And the first principle that's put forward has to do with a certainty that God establishes that there be freedom on the horizon. God wants freedom for his people. Whether, in fact, after 6 years or not, the person has fully paid back their debt, 6 years was the limit. And though slavery existed of this type in Israel, clearly the principle is that God would have his covenant people not be in servitude, not be in a bondage where they don't have the freedom to serve him freely, completely freely. They are not to live at the mercy of another, but rather are to be self-directed, or maybe I could say it this way, and this makes sense, self-controlled, that they would have control over themselves. Indeed, Christians will later be exhorted, of course, won't they, to demonstrate this fruit of the Spirit, that they be self-controlled. For example, listen to some of the language that God talks about in terms of his covenant people. Psalm 102, verses 18 to 20. Let this be recorded for a generation to come, so that a people yet to be created may praise the Lord, that he looked down from his holy height from heaven. The Lord looked at the earth to hear the groans of the prisoners, to set free those who were doomed to die. God look down upon the earth and wants people to be free. Jeremiah 34 is probably one of the clearest situations in Israel's history with King Zedekiah, who was trying to bring reformation about. This is what we read. King Zedekiah had made a covenant with all the people in Jerusalem to make a proclamation of liberty to them, that everyone should set free his Hebrew slaves, male and female, so that no one should enslave a Jew, his brother. They put an end to that practice, and he goes on, and they obeyed all the officials and all the people who had entered into the covenant that everyone should set free his slave, male or female, so that they would not be enslaved again. They obeyed and set them free. But afterward, they turned around and took back the male and female slaves they had set free and bought them into subjection as slaves. Well, you read on and you find what God does with that result, what they had done. He was pleased with the setting free, with the proclamation, but as soon as they turn back on it again and enslave themselves, he brings great punishment upon them. Galatians 5:1 tells of God's intent. For freedom, Christ has set you free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Now, he's speaking there in that context to some Judaism and going back to some bonds of some of the old law and so on. But the idea here is that God has set you free from bondage to these things. Romans 8:20 and 21 is like it when it says, for the creation was subjected to futility, talking about creation now, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption to obtain the, now listen to the phrase, the freedom of the glory of the children of God. The earth is kind of wanting to be like the children of God who are said to be free. So these passages emphasize God's intent for his covenant people. He's all about justice. And so if one man owes another, of course he must pay that bill back. But 6 years of service is enslavement that will in fact be sort of a limit that he's putting on this, an upper limit. After that, that work God had been done, God in effect was setting that person free. The master could have no more claim on him. That, like what will follow, is fencing in, again, a limiting of man's inclination to take advantage. You know, even if you do have a debt, be careful that you don't over, if you're the master, as it were, be careful that you don't take advantage of the other. Now, of course, on the flip side, a man should labor not to get into this situation, right? Not to fall into debt like this. He must not sell his freedom in order to pay for material things. Too many Christians have bought into this idea of materialism in the world so that they buy on credit what they cannot afford. And so in so doing, they become indentured servants to either the bank or to the credit company or whatever, credit card company or whatever. But Christians have to avoid that so that they might be free. And in fact, Christians ought to work if they can to help others be free as well. In our very next chapter, verse 25, God is very clear that his people were not to treat one another that way, not to extract interest from those who found it difficult to pay. Quote, "If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a moneylender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him." In other words, don't take advantage of his need for money and to put him in an indebted situation so that he's bound. God goes so far as to demand a generosity from the one who is owed. On the seventh year, he was not merely to send his servant away. He's actually to send him away with gifts. He's to send him away liberally in what he needs. Now, this typical situation, again, in this kind of servitude that God was calling for, in contrast to all the surrounding nations, was that the servant who is there, employed in the household trying to pay off his debt, is to be treated like a family member. Not merely a tool to be used to get work done and so on. And that explains verse 5, where a slave is said, and we wouldn't recognize this in any other context, but where a slave desires to stay with his master, right? I love my master, he's saying here, and I want to stay. God would have masters treat their servants so well that this would be the desire of the slave, that I want to live in that context forever. This is such a good situation. In the New Testament, we have the relationship between Onesimus, who was a slave, and is discussed in Paul's letter to Philemon. Listen to how Paul's dialogue reflects God's heart here. "I would have been glad to keep him with me," that's the slave, "in order that he might serve me on your behalf during my imprisonment for the gospel. But I preferred to do nothing without your consent in order that your goodness might not be compulsion, but of your own accord. For this perhaps is why he was parted from you for a while, that you might have him back forever. No longer as a bondservant, but more than a bondservant, as a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord." So this is the ideal. This is kind of the relationship that takes place. This is just one view. So that's the indebted servant. God has compassion for that relationship situation. The next category God reveals is his protection of the family as a unit. In verse 3, in that matter of slaves indentured to masters, and later in verse 7 with the matter of a man selling his daughter into this kind of relationship, generally, by the way, that would be for marriage. You sell your daughter into a slavery situation so that she becomes his wife. But God reveals in his restriction of evil here that he's concerned to keep the family unit to be honored, to keep it in highest regard. And of course, that flows right out of the commandment itself, to honor your father and mother. If a slave has a wife, that wife is not to be taken from him by the master. That relationship is a bond. If the master gave him a wife during his slavery, when he's set free, she is to remain presumably with the master for a time. But the idea there, of course, is that if the man has been set free, then he's not in an indebted situation anymore, and he may be in a position to redeem her, to buy her back so that they can be united again. That's the goal here. In the case of a daughter sold into slavery, she's to remain to serve the master, but if the master keeps her as a wife, then he may not treat her in any other relationship than he would in a marriage relationship, right? If he mistreats her, if he kind of goes through, as so much of the culture at this time was doing, and saying, "I'm displeased with this woman, I will rid myself of her," then he has to allow her to be redeemed so that she might be back in the family unit context again. If he's designated her for his son, okay, I buy the slave for the purpose of my son having a wife, and things don't go well with there, he must not treat her in any other way than his own daughter. It's a family unit that's to be taken in view here. Another example of God's concern for the family, again in the spelling out of this commandment, is in verse 15 and 17. The application of the principle spelled out in the fifth commandment to honor your father and your mother. How is it seen here? Well, no one's to strike their parent. If they strike them, this is how high in regard we are to hold that relationship. If they strike the parent, they're to be put to death. Whoever curses his father or his mother shall be put to death. You see how highly we're to regard that relationship. Quite apart from the violence of the act of striking is the blatant disregard for the who this is that we're talking about, who should be honored and respected. So the punishment is severe because God is highlighting, he's driving home how important a mother, how important a father is, how highly they're to be respected. You'll notice that the punishment is equal without, again, even in a culture like we have here where men and women are not treated equally, nevertheless, the women and the men are treated equally as parents. That if a mother is cursed, then the one who has done so is to be put to death, just as much as the father. Well, then we move on to reveal his protection, God's protection over those who are, I'm calling, disenfranchised or powerless. And again, in this culture, often this means women. Most of the women represented in this passage are in less than ideal situations. Marriage was a valued thing. Certainly there's nothing unequal or invaluable in marriage, but marriage was a valued arrangement for women in this day, which were largely not able to make their own living. They didn't have the means of that kind of thing. So being in a marriage was a valuable thing, even sometimes to be taken as a second wife. Now, we can't even imagine this because we recognize the sin of it, but in a wicked culture, to be a second wife might provide actually means for you to live where you did not have other means. It's one of the only means women had to be provided for. It provides security to some extent. But in this messy and sinful world where you have a second marriage, where you're having men taking advantage of women, often men would view the woman as a lesser creature, in a sense, to be used for his disposal and his convenience and disposed of just as easily. And many of these wives being spoken of are women sold into slavery for the purpose of marriage. And because men were able to wield the power, they had the influence, the women were marginalized. And so God gives laws. He gives restrictions to help protect them. Reveals principles here that put a stop to that mistreatment of the women in that way. The men were not to be considered, were not to consider their marriages as a light commitment. They were to care for their wives. It's during this time period, if you want to get a sense of the mess of the culture, this is the time period in which God is said to have permitted Moses to issue certificates of divorce. What was the reason? Because of the hardness of the people's hearts, you see. That's the condition. But the men, even in those situations where divorces were permitted, were held accountable for it. You'll see it here. And slave or no slave, if a man takes a second wife, he was not permitted to treat her differently. He was not to demean her. He was to treat her with honor just as he would his first wife. Verse 10, if he takes another wife, he should not diminish her food or her clothing or her marital rights. Marriage is marriage, and God honored it. Well, in a society that does not give the same rights to women as it did to men, this was God's safeguard for them. He is concerned for the weak. He's concerned for the powerless. And it's not as though the presence of slavery, the presence of polygamy in their culture, the presence of abuse in the Israelite camp are indications that God somehow approved of them. You know, just because we see laws ordering these things does not sort of give us the sense that God is okay with slavery or that he's okay with polygamy any more than he's okay later on with murder. God talks about these existing in the culture, but he gives limits and instructions on how to deal with them. That's what we see going on here. Young women, second wives, those captured, sold to others, and so on. What's the point of all this? We're to see God's concern for those who are powerless. Those who are being taken advantage of, God cares for them. And for those who are in our society who are not in a position to change their status, who can't do anything about it because of where they are and who they are. That's something God's concerned about. Fourth, finally, we see God's protection of human life. The sixth commandment was worded in the negative, right? You shall not murder. Well, that seems like something we can all avoid. I'm not going to go out and kill someone, so I'm okay. But the principle behind these things is that God's people must value and uphold and seek to preserve life. That's the positive response to the commandment of God. Genesis 9 had already introduced the death penalty for those who commit murder. But here you go one step farther by speaking of manslaughter. What do we do in the case of manslaughter where a person kills another without necessarily intending to do so? Maybe they got into a heated argument and one hurts the other to the point where that person is killed. Well, the punishment is not death in that case, but it is still very severe. And that is, it's to try to, that a man might learn to revere and to value life, that mankind would understand the value of life. Even in the case if this individual was a slave. If a death occurs because of the master's actions, that death is to be avenged. Here's somebody who's considered, again, it's not necessarily in God's eyes, but considered in society as a lesser person. But if that person is killed, God values the life enough to say that's required of you. Verses 22 and 23 indicate God's value of life and how central this is to our day. Value of life in the womb. How clear is this passage about God's value of a life in the womb? It's very clear. And we see here that God considers that human life. Because if men are fighting and they cause the death of that baby in the womb, then they are required to pay. Notice what it says. Life, your life, for life. It doesn't call it for a fetus or something of that nature. He calls it a life. This is a life that God has given. And so your life will be required for the life of that child. Because God made himself, God made man in his image, all mankind has value, even those in the womb. Even the freedom to use their bodies as intended is valued and protected here. It's very key here. This even affects the lowest in society, that slave. If a slave is struck in such a way that he loses an eye or a tooth, what is to take place? You forfeit all indebted, that all of that debt is gone. That person may go free at that moment because you have violated his life. You've impacted his life, his freedom to use his own body and so on with freedom. This is nothing other than a mistreat of people. God's viewing the slave, he's viewing the woman, he's viewing all of those considered lesser in society as valued individuals. And God would have his people view them the same way. All others, whether men or women, slave or free, old or young, they're to be valued individuals created by God and for God. Yes, there may be arrangements and relationships that exist in a culture where one person has more authority than the other. You know, certain characters in the government may have more authority or whatever it may be. But that authority does not give license for mistreatment of the other person as a person. Well, let me conclude this by bringing down hopefully some life application for us. Perhaps it goes without saying that if God is one who honors by his character, he's concerned for certain people and to protect certain things and uphold certain things and certain people, then so must the church. If God upholds it, the church must uphold it. Regardless of what age or circumstances we live in, if we know this to be true of the character of God, then it ought to be reflected in our actions as well. We, too, live in a messy world, filled with all kinds of things that are wrong, things that are wicked, people who take advantage of others because they're in positions of power or affluence or influence. And the Ten Commandments are to be applied in the many and varied principles that flow from them. We're to be safeguarders ourselves of those things that God safeguards in these case studies as we see them in the next couple chapters. We're to fight for the rights of those trapped in servitude and indebtedness, such that they have lost their freedom. Believers must avoid indebtedness themselves insofar as they're able. Romans 13:8 expresses it pretty clearly. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. The principle is not to go into any debt that you simply could not repay if you were forced to. And Christians must seek to aid those who are trapped in those bonds that they might be free to serve Christ. Well, next, the church must continue to fight for the well-being of the family. Well, this has been one that's very clear to us, right, in our day, that we recognize we need to fight for the family. Again, it starts with us, that Christian husbands are to love and sacrifice themselves for their wives. They're to treat their wives with value and honor and be rid of any of this sense of lording it over them. Their power, their position, that's not of God. Women, of course, are to honor their husbands. They're to love their husbands and submit to them. But beyond that, we together must fight for healthy marriages. that stay together, that the family units are together. Marriages that are established as God intended between one man and one woman for life. The family is the central unit and most powerful influence on society. And so when the family begins to disintegrate, the society disintegrates. And God honors the family. He upholds that family, that institution. Then we must put on the character of God in our protection of those who are powerless and have become marginalized. Well, who is that in our day? We could make a long list, right? It could be the poor. It can be the young. It could be those who haven't had much education, those trapped in addiction who are powerless to overcome it, those with serious health concerns who have no ability to change their circumstances because of their health, and so on. We could make a long list, but we need to be careful as a church and as individuals to uphold those who are in this position. You can't claw their way out. Keeping God's law, these Ten Commandments, is more than avoiding the breaking of the Ten Commandments. You understand that, right? It's more than just not committing adultery, not stealing. We have to honor these things, and that's what the case studies are doing. They're bringing out the principles to take the positive side of things. And we consider the second table of the law particularly. We must be active then in honoring our parents, honoring the family unit, honoring that relationship between parents and their children. We need to promote life, not just not take life. We need to promote life in all areas of life. Fostering healthy marriages, being not just not committing adultery, but fostering healthy marriages, being diligent in our work, telling the truth, being thankful for what we have, not just not coveting, being thankful for what we have, contented in all the things. These are the positive ways we try to put these into practice. May God strengthen you as individuals in His church to put these principles into play. And let's ask Him for help. Let's pray.